The first time I saw Suran was at one of Charles's parties, though I'm still not sure how she got on the list. She was an Italian that night, a 60s film star, all hips and olive eyes, her hair piled up on top of her head. In fact, Suran had never been to Italy, not there. She was a Serb, and maybe that goes some way to explaining her. Some incident of war, perhaps, searing and impossible to detach from the skin, had made her incandescent. As for the name, it turned out she'd seen it on a restaurant the week she arrived in Paris. She didn't know what it meant, but it made her difficult to place, and she liked that. Charles spotted her right away. His eyes flicked across her body like a tongue. She claimed to be an artist, and I regret to say I dismissed that. Performance art, she said. Convenient, I thought. No one was going to ask to see her etchings. Most days I worked in Charles's house, not at the gallery. Suran would emerge from his bedroom in the early afternoon, half-dressed and smelling of sex, long after Charles himself had left for lunch. She took my breath away. How empty that sounds, I know, but I have no other words. Comically, I took up jogging, pounding my way along the stone-walled river and up through the Champ de Mars, but it was no use. She was everywhere. And then the impossible happened. There was a New Year dinner, a band that didn't show, followed by a spectacular row that drove Charles to his bed and Suran to mine. That night, it felt like the old world had just exploded, while the fireworks whizzed and whistled overhead. But Charles's empire is not just a Parisian affair. There are auction houses in the obvious places, a chalet somewhere. After that New Year dinner, he took Suran away for several weeks. He claimed that business detained him, but I think he knew what had happened. When at last they returned, just before Easter, Suran told me to be patient. "After Venice," she said. "I'll leave him after that." Charles came to find me in the library. He looked me straight in the eye. "The Biennale is important, Harry. You should come along, help with the exhibition, make the right contacts, and just have fun." He gave a curt little smile, then walked away. That was the time to have extricated myself. I might have found a museum job if I'd done it then. Instead, I trailed along after them like a puppy. We arrived in Venice in early June. I'd never been before, and neither had Suran. We stood at the back of the water taxi like a pair of spoilt brats and oohed and aahed as Charles sat paternally inside. The family had a vast place opposite the Palazzo Balbi. The ground floor had been abandoned to the water ever since the flood of 66, but the rest of it was magnificent. From the start, we lived on the grandest floor. A long hall, really, with a four-arched window onto the Grand Canal. With its multiple doorways and the chairs ranged along its length, it felt like a waiting room. Suran is not accustomed to waiting, but even she seemed dazzled by that room. When she and Charles had gone out to do some dazzling of their own, I used to sit there in her place. At night, I'd gaze up into the Seguso chandelier, Charles's pride and joy. Or turn it off and simply look out at the Palazzo Balbi opposite, or at the red snouts of the fireboats tucked into their shallow arched berths in the Rio alongside. For all the water, the place felt like a tinderbox. The heat was too much for Charles, and when he took to his bed in the afternoons, Suran took me to hers. It was a courtesan's boudoir, all frill and fluff, with a huge scallop-edged mirror that gathered the glints of hard light on busy water and blared them around the room. Everything sparkled, including us. We were sheer performance art. All summer long we went to parties, Suran and Charles and me. Suran wore watery silks that changed colour with the light. Everywhere she picked up new and shiny things to hang about herself like charms. And Charles, so elegant in his pale linen suit, walked stiffly down the river with Suran almost dancing along beside him. He was like a man approaching winter who'd been granted an unexpected spring. I could have eaten myself with jealousy, trailing after them. dying for Venice to end, and Paris, and the whole charade. By autumn, Suran had gone off Venice. The boudoir was a padded cell, she said, and the city was killing her. She was stifled, bored, stagnant. Her art was going nowhere. I feel trapped, Harry. I never knew hell could be made of water. Then she opened the shutters of her room and screamed down into the canal, I hate you, Venice. With just a month of Biennale left to run, it was obvious that our exhibition wasn't going to happen. Charles refused to name a date, though he did agree to a party. Suran was beside herself with excitement. For once, she seemed to have forgotten Paris. She spoke of being launched like some great doomed ship. She sat for hours at the iMac, tapping and fretting in search of the perfect tableau. She worked her way through her stash of Marlborough lights and 3 centuries' worth of Venetian masters. Out went all the colourfully martyred saints, the sorrowful Madonnas. As for the Venus of Urbino, she's just a rich man's tease, Harry, she said. Venus is good, though. At last, she settled on her theme, Venus with a mirror. Suran couldn't admit to showing off. She had to make it sound like a manifesto. I'm reworking Titian, she said. The goddess and the male gaze. Mirror as weapon. I wondered if she should say something to Charles. Of course not, she said. It would spoil the surprise. Charles never could resist a party. He did his usual tour of duty, sampling the Cicchetti and the wines. Suran's stage was a chaise longue, spotlit and draped in layers of brocade and crushed raspberry velvet. I saw him register it, but he said nothing. When Suran made her entrance, she was draped in velvet too. Her hair, blonde this evening, was threaded through with pearls. Once she had the attention of the room, she let her wrap fall to her waist and arranged one arm across those magnificent breasts. In her other hand was the mirror. The room reeled. Who is she? Someone asked. Isn't that obvious? Said an American in wraparound shades. She's a personification. Venice the whore. Always out for what she can get. But the girl, should I know her? I doubt it, the American said. It's probably some burlesque act he brought from Paris. Nobody mentioned Titian. Suran angled her mirror at one of the spotlights strung on steel wire beneath the coffered ceiling and began deflecting the light back among the partygoers. She was aiming the mirror, her face tense, but her targets just shielded their eyes and turned to their backs. Without an audience, she was powerless. She looked pale, frail, washed up on her velvet island. I wanted to cover her up, light her a cigarette, but she would have broken that mirror over my head. Charles completely ignored the whole thing. I watched him. She might as well not have been there. Eventually, Suran seemed to recognize she'd lost the room. She slumped back, exhausted, and I brought her a glass of champagne. She took it from me, knocked it back, then told me to piss off. The whole of the following week she sat knotted up on the chaise, smoking furiously. Now and then she would pull on her patent boots and clack her way down the staircase. I don't know where she went, but she was gone for hours. Finally, she stayed away an entire night and day. Suddenly, comradely, we were both distraught as we made our way home through the dark slap of water. The buildings nearby are often unlit these days, their owners decamped or dead. Nothing much changes, so when something does, it's a shock. Charles was first to notice it. A chandelier burned behind the 4-arched window, but Charles's Seguso was gone. This one was a blood-red monstrosity. It had a dozen or so lights and more curls than a carnival wig. I think Charles used the word affront. It was expensive, too. I saw Charles sign the check when the invoice arrived the following morning. But most hideous of all were the little black glass cauldrons that concealed the light bulbs. In each of these burned a little hell, its flames formed from orange and yellow twists of glass, stoked by a pair of devils. Suran left no note, took nothing with her but her clothes. For a week or so, Charles was sure she'd return, but then he changed his tune. Perhaps she contacted him, he never said. She never got in touch with me. One day he simply decided she was gone for good and took to his bed for the rest of the week. Meanwhile, I called her constantly, but there was never any reply. Finally, a voice announced that the number was no longer in use. I swallowed my pride and asked everyone I knew in Paris to let me know if she turned up, in a gallery perhaps, or at a bar. Eventually, belief shrank into hope before fizzling out like an acid burn. I still Google her now and then. I use all the names I know, but then she's probably someone else now. Most mornings, Charles and I eat breakfast together. We look out on the Volta, where the Grand Canal makes a sudden lurch to the right. The window, formed from four slim arches, chops the view into frames of a film that's still playing itself out. Life churns away out there. Inside, there's rarely much to say. Venice is like that. There is surface, and then there's the business underneath. I should have done it right away. I should have left him then and there, but it's too late now. We must make an odd spectacle, Charles and I, as we amble along together. Charles speaks of her frequently, now that time has pulled the sting. He is often ill, damp, Venetian afflictions of the chest and joints. He should leave Venice, of course, but he won't. We may get an extra decade these days, he likes to say, but it's reclaimed land, swampy and unreliable. As for me, life churns away outside the four-arched window, but I have not yet stopped the film and seized a frame for myself. I've missed the boat when it comes to museum jobs, and the real world with its motorways and car parks seems daunting to me now. So, day after day, Charles and I breakfast together beneath the chandelier, the little hell she gave us. The sun catches those cadmium flames, while outside the fireboats come and go. Sometimes I catch him glancing up at it. I know he thinks, no, hopes that she'll return. He's never asked me what I think or what I hope. He doesn't seem to wonder why I stay. Charles is still the master, even now. He doesn't seem to realize that Venus played us both.
That was Venus and A Little Hell by Anne-Marie Neary, read by Robert O'Mahony and produced by Aoife Ní Cormac. It's a shortlisted story from the 2014 RTE Radio Francis McManus Short Story Competition. The series of this year's 25 shortlisted stories continues tomorrow with He's Going Nowhere, Your Son by Fiona O'Rourke, read by Catherine Walsh. The shortlisted stories and other information are on the programme website on rte.ie/radio1/Francis McManus short story. The series producer is Cliona Ní Eanluain.